Bet the board.
What do you mean you don't bet?
I mean, I don't bet. You know, I don't care. I don't. I never have, and I never will.
Yeah, right.
I'll bet you $20 I can get you gambling before the end of the day.
You owe me $15,000, pal.
Pay him. Pay that man his money.
It's the Bet the Board podcast.
God likes me. He really, really likes me.
In the end, I wound up right back where I started. I could still pick winners, and I could still make money for all kinds of people back home. And why mess up a good thing?
Here's Payne Insider and Todd Furman.
Welcome into the Bet the Board podcast, NFL Week 5 edition. Plenty of great games on the docket, a little bit of breakfast football again this week for those of us out here on the West Coast, and a marquee matchup in Sunday Night Football that we'll get to before we close things out. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by my esteemed colleague and co-host, the one, the only Payne Insider. And Payne, I can only hope that your week is going more swimmingly than what we saw from the Rams offense against the 49ers on Monday Night Football.
Boy, you might have jinxed us and our listeners don't even know it yet.
Maybe I shouldn't have brought it up, but at the same time, we always have to review what we saw last, and that was a Rams offense that was ill-equipped to attack anything defensively that D'Amico Ryans has thrown his way. But maybe more importantly, for going glass half full, Jimmy Garoppolo, limited sample size, did what he needed to, and the 49ers, an amazing beneficiary of poor tackling in that secondary.
My suspicion leads me to believe that we'll be discussing the Rams a couple times on this podcast. So without divulging too much at this stage, I think you're right. When you looked at Jimmy G, he was comfortable. And that was one thing that we talked about multiple times when we gave out the best bet on the first half under, when we broke it down again on Monday. Jimmy G wasn't going to see a bunch of pressure for whatever reason. It's basically just Aaron Donald at this point. The Rams aren't getting pressure defensively. And so Jimmy G was going to be able to sit back there and feel comfortable. And, you know, you had some injuries in the secondary for the Rams as well. And that's one thing we talked about. It's like Jimmy G can operate this offense when he's not pressured. And he did a fantastic job of that. Was one of the best quarterbacks of the week in a lot of metrics. Was fantastic getting the ball out on time, letting guys make some plays after the catch. The ground game wasn't its typical self, but it was, you know, efficient enough to stay multiple. And I think that's kind of the big thing you're looking at now is, can the 49ers get a little bit healthier along the offensive line? I'm hearing some rumblings. They may make some moves here to enhance the interior. I think, obviously, the left tackle situation isn't what you had hoped for with that injury, but my guess is that gets solved a little bit sooner than the prognosis there, just because the man's an absolute horse.
And you know what? To the 49ers' credit, their defensive line performed exceedingly well, despite not having Eric Armstead and Javon Kinlaw out there for a lion's share of that game. So good performance all the way around. It's amazing what one new data point can do to erase some of the concerns that we saw manifest Sunday night against the Denver Broncos, which provides the perfect segue into Thursday Night Football, where we'll get to see the Denver Broncos in primetime yet again, this time playing host to the Indianapolis Colts. And when you look across the betting landscape here, a lot of three minus 20s out there. There are some 3.5s with Denver installed as a home favorite. We've already seen under money come in on this game with a peak total of 43.5, now down to 42. Even a prominent shop hanging a 41.5 as we record here on Thursday morning. And this is a battle of underachieving veteran quarterbacks, at least through the first 4 weeks. Russell Wilson is shown to be a little bit more comfortable with some of the new pieces in Denver. Matt Ryan, anything but, as ball security is a major concern right now behind that Indianapolis offensive line. Both teams go into this game without bell cow backs. Of course, we know from Deepak that Javonte Williams lost for the season. Jonathan Taylor a little nicked up. Tough to be out there in short turnaround, especially playing at altitude. And these are two of the three lowest scoring teams in the league through the first 4 weeks. The Colts' 57 points are their fewest through four games since 1998, which ironically enough was Peyton Manning's rookie season. Meanwhile, the Broncos' 66 points are their fewest through four games since 2006, where they had 49 total. We know about Russell Wilson in prime time. He lived up and exceeded expectations when we saw him against the 49ers. The Broncos, meanwhile, have become one of the best under teams in the league. The Colts on a long under streak as well. When you try and assess some of the X's and O's tonight as a football junkie that you are, what is the matchup you're most interested in watching unfold?
It's a good question. I think there's some things on both sides of the ball, and you kind of made mention of the Colts' struggles offensively right now, and I think they're obvious. Now, if Jonathan Taylor returns, and that's a questionable thing, right? It's a high ankle sprain. Do you force him out there a little bit earlier and have that linger throughout the course of the season? Do you allow him just to get healthy? I think if you were to zoom out 6 weeks from now, the offense is going to look a little bit better. You have Matt Ryan learning a brand new system. Frank Reich, as we know, runs a pretty complex scheme. It's got a lot of structure to it. So that's one reason the Colts offense is dead last in schedule adjusted efficiency right now, and by a healthy margin. The other is talent. You know, I think we've grown accustomed to the Colts offensive line being dominant in recent years. It's not right now. And I think we envision some trail off there, but we're talking about bottom of the barrel bad through 4 weeks, both in protection and creating space for the ground game. 26th in pass block win rate are the Colts. 31st in adjusted line yards. The Colts running backs are averaging 1.1 yards per rush before first contact. So just dreadful O-line play across the board. And when you think about, you know, tonight's game and how you want to attack the Broncos defense, it's on the ground. Denver's 20th in schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. They brought in DJ Jones from San Francisco. He's still the number one right now, defensive tackle and run-stop win rate, and yet Denver's 20th. The Colts don't get a ton of push, though, and now you mentioned Jonathan Taylor's out for this one, we know, and you're a run-first offense to begin with because Indy right now, early down, pass rate is 4% below expectation, so they are very much run-first. When they do go and drop back to throw it, Colts offense isn't performing well, and now they're stepping up in class as well. I know there appeared to be, I would say, some signs of progress last week against the Titans pass defense, but Tennessee's 26th through the air defensively. You look at Denver, even without Justin Simmons, who's an all-world safety, the Broncos are 6th in defensive pass efficiency. Then you start to look at the schedule of passing defenses the Colts have faced this season. 3 of the 4 teams are below average defending the pass. The one team through 4 weeks that's in the same class as Denver right now is Jacksonville. Colts scored 0 points in that game. I'm not saying that's what's going to transpire here this evening, but, you know, short week, on the road, offense not quite in sync, your horse on offense is out. And so I can't really see a reason to project an offensive outburst here offensively for the Colts.
Yeah, you have to imagine that the Colts erring on the side of caution with Jonathan Taylor has a lot to do with what they have on deck. I mean, because of a scheduling quirk, the Colts will finish 5 of their games against AFC South opponents by the time we get to week 8. I mean, next Sunday, they'll host Jacksonville. The following week, they'll go at Tennessee. You want Taylor healthy for those games. Not that you're throwing in the towel for tonight, but if he can't go in those two contests, obviously much bigger ramifications than what you would see unfold here. And you'd have to hope, if you're Indianapolis, this is the free Nyheim Hines game. I mean, you look at his prop numbers all in the low 70s. We know how dynamic he can be as a receiver out of the backfield. We'll see how the Colts elect to run the football, knowing it's a homecoming of sorts for Philip Lindsay, who performed extremely well as a member of the Broncos backfield and also during his time at Boulder. On the other side of the ball, Payne, the big injury for Indianapolis is to Shaq Leonard. We waited for him to come back and be active. He's out there for a half, a broken nose, a concussion later. He will not be out there for this game. Meanwhile, you look at this Denver Broncos offense, 16.5 points per game. As we said, the fewest through 4 games since 2006. Their red zone touchdown percentage is awful. Their punt rate is amongst the worst in the NFL. And now you're trying to operate without Javonte Williams, as Melvin Gordon has had fumbling problems. But the one thing I will say, watching that Raiders game back a second time, Russell Wilson appears to be more comfortable. And the one thing, if you're a Broncos fan, you have to be encouraged by, it was the first time all season he looked willing and able to take off from the pocket and extend plays.
That's interesting. You watched more of that game than I did. They felt very spurty.
Oh, there's no consistency by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. It feels like 3 and out, or they put together 40 or 50 yard drives.
Yeah, I mean, even like the first 10 points the Broncos scored there, they were all on short fields, and then it was kind of when they got pushed to score, right? Like the one drive before the half when it was starting to look like it was getting out of hand, and then you had the one drive late. It's not very consistent, and I think the one thing that we have to touch on a little bit, and it's probably not a huge deal, but it's something to monitor. Russell Wilson's been limited all week with a throwing shoulder issue. They're calling it tendonitis. Again, it might not be a massive impact here, but something to think about and monitor as we as the season kind of progresses here. You mentioned no Javonte Williams, of course. Unfortunate there. It looks like a 15-month-plus injury.
Brutal.
Denver struggles offensively, though, to me, at least in the data. They're getting worse. Like, initially, if you remember the conversations we were having, we were, like, chalking it up to negative red zone variance and negative goal-to-goal situation variance because through 2 weeks, Denver was top 10 in EPA per play. Now, after 4 weeks, we're looking at a Denver offense outside the top 20 in schedule-adjusted efficiency and EPA. So the down-to-down efficiency has actually dipped from when we thought, hey, maybe things can get turned around if your, you know, your red zone variance enhances. Denver obviously has played an elite defense in San Francisco, won the game, but churned out a 31% success rate, and it is ugly if you remove that last drive. Other three games, the Broncos offense has played three defenses all outside the top 20. The Colts defense will be the second toughest they've faced this season, so they are going up in class a little bit here. The Colts right now, second best in schedule-adjusted rush defense right behind the 49ers, and you mentioned Shaq Leonard out. And sure, that's a loss. You were hoping to get him back. He returns, concussion, broken nose. But they've lived life without Shaq Leonard in 14 of 16 quarters this season. And I think what's interesting is, you know, the guys that have replaced him have played pretty well. The other element here when you look at this Colts defense is Kenny Moore and Yannick Ngakoue are playing horrifically. If those two guys were stocks, you'd be buying at the bottom because there's only one direction for those two to go. And despite those, you know, three key cogs, when you add Shaq Leonard to Moore and Ngakoue, this is a Colts defense that's kind of knocking on the door of being top 10 in schedule adjusted efficiency. Indy plays a high rate of zone coverage, and Russell Wilson, through this four-game sample with the Broncos, has been QB 33. In EPA per pass attempt against zone. The Colts are also getting more pressure this season than last year when they were second worst in the league. It's still not, you know, this astronomical rate of pressure, but they've gotten a little bit better there. And again, I think if Ngakoue gets things figured out, that'll help. But Kwity Paye has been kind of growing and emerging there. But the point here is, like, we know Russ is holding on to the ball forever. Eighth highest time to throw. Billy Turner, highly questionable. At right tackle for this evening, so keep monitoring that situation. But the point here is, you know, we've already broken down the Colts offense, and now we're sitting here saying, you know, there's not some great matchup advantage for the Broncos offensively either, and you start stacking all of these elements of, you know, no Javonte, Russ being limited all week with a shoulder, Broncos going up in class against a Colts defense, Russell Wilson not performing overly well against zone, which is what the Colts seem to live in. And you can see why the under was hit first half at 21.5 and now, you know, 44 full as well. And that's why that number you referenced is down to as low as 41.5.
Don't have to be a math wizard to figure out if you're QB 33 and there's only 32 teams in the National Football League, it doesn't bode really well for you and what you're able to produce in certain situations. We'll see if one of these teams can right the ship at least for 60 minutes tonight. Both came into the year with very high expectations. The Colts in a much more favorable division that if you lose this game, it's not an absolute death knell, but the seat will continue to get hotter under Frank Reich. The silver lining for Indianapolis, we talked about it in our preseason preview podcast. September had not been a good month for this franchise. They typically get better as the season goes. They'll be looking for a spark. We'll see if it comes tonight on the road in one of the more difficult places to play in the National Football League at altitude in Denver. From Denver tonight, Payne, to London on Sunday morning, and the Green Bay Packers will make their maiden voyage overseas, first time they're ever playing outside of the United States in the franchise's long, illustrious history. Meanwhile, the Giants, this is a team that surprised some folks with a 3-1 start, although a lot of folks will believe that there's some smoke and mirrors to what they've been able to accomplish. But at the same time, it's the first team with 3+ wins to be a touchdown underdog in the fifth game going all the way back to 2015. When the Panthers were in that particular role, they went on to play for the Super Bowl. Let's pump the brakes, Giants fans. I'm not saying that's going to be the case here. Meanwhile, Green Bay, they've thrived under Matt LaFleur when they're installed as a big favorite. 17-0 straight up as a touchdown favorite under LaFleur. In those games, Rodgers, 42 touchdowns, 3 interceptions. We saw them get pushed last weekend by the New England Patriots. Patriots. Touchdown favorites historically have performed pretty well in London. 6-1 ATS, they're on a 6-0 ATS run. The first time we saw that, the team floundered. Meanwhile, the Giants, they've been a model of consistency. They've seen 41 or fewer points scored in all four of their games this season. But Payne, I put all of that out there to ask you this question. The Giants haven't seen a living, breathing offense just yet. I'm not quite sure the Packers are there, but this could be a legitimate jolt to their system when they have to deal with a myriad of Packers weapons operating in space, especially in the wake of Aaron Rodgers pretty much saying we have to be better offensively to take pressure off our defense.
Yeah, so this is a game that we'll quick hit a little bit here. We wouldn't break it down, I don't think, unless it was the London game, although both teams are 3-1. I think there's two things here, and one on each side of the ball. The first for the Giants offensively is it's a good sign that Daniel Jones will play because the Giants didn't sign any of the quarterbacks that worked out earlier this week.
How dare you talk poorly about Jake Fromm and A.J. McCarron? How dare you, Payne?
I was told it would be Davis Webb anyway. So that's how, you know, the Tyrod Taylor concussion situation, Daniel Jones ankle sprain. Davis Webb was going to be in line to start, but they were trying these guys out to find a backup. That's how bleak it looked initially, but all signs point to Daniel Jones trying to give it a go. Now, I don't think he's going to be as mobile as he's shown so far this season. And for fantasy guys, 49% of Jones' production has come rushing the ball. Most of those runs have been out of necessity because the poor guy's been pressured on 50% of his dropbacks. Now, that's basically a combination of the Giants' O-line being 25th in pass block win rate and then receivers not being able to separate in a timely fashion, right? That's not a good combination. The four leading receivers and targets are combining to average 1.2 yards per route run. That is not good. Green Bay is ninth in pressure rate, so I would think they're going to be able to get some heat on Daniel Jones, who's less than 100%. Now, watching last week's game, the first thought you have is the Giants should be able to run the ball. That's how you attack Green Bay. Schematically, that is the way you would want to focus your efforts offensively against a defense that plays with five defensive backs. They play with a lighter box. The Patriots ran up and down the field, obviously. The Packers allowed 64% of New England's runs to be successful. It was the highest mark in week four. So that's kind of your mindset here. And on the surface, the Giants are seventh in schedule-adjusted rushing efficiency. So just hand it off to Saquon with this matchup. That's probably the thought process. It makes sense. But I would pause slightly, because the Giants' O-line isn't creating this crazy amount of push for these efficiency numbers to kind of withstand this season. Now, I understand the schedule, right, of defense isn't great, but when you look at the amount of push that's being created, the Giants' O-line's actually below average in adjusted line yards. The Giants' rushing success rate is very much a byproduct of Saquon being Superman. You know, knock on wood, you never want to see that guy get healthy again, but he has just been fantastic. He's averaging more than 1.6 rushing yards above expectation every time he takes a handoff. So it's really been him helping this ground game and not necessarily the hogs up front creating room for him. If you're the Packers DC Joe Barry, right? You got torched last week on the ground against New England. You see Daniel Jones isn't 100%. The Giants receiver group isn't threatening. The Giants, you know, have shown this ability to run it a little bit. You have to focus on stopping the run this week. And for as bad as, you know, the season long metrics for Green Bay defensively against the run look, I go back to week three against Tampa. Tom Brady a little bit banged up. Receiver group has injuries and a suspension, so it's not really threatening. Fournette is the man you needed to worry about, just like Saquon is this week. And the Packers dedicated more defenders to the box and were fourth best in EPA per rush allowed that week against Tampa. That has to be the same strategy here. Quickly, though, to your question atop on the other side of the ball. Look at who the Giants have faced. It's Ryan Tannehill. It's Baker Mayfield.
Murderer's row of elite NFL quarterbacks to this point in the season. I don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's Baker Mayfield at home. It's Cooper Rush at home. It's Justin Fields at home. It's the second easiest schedule of offenses faced through the quarter pole. Now you get Aaron Rodgers. You get a Packers offense that is getting healthier. And I think some of their underlying metrics would suggest that they're getting ready to kind of just surge here a little bit. And you mentioned that quote from Aaron Rodgers this week. It sounds like he's pressing the coaching staff, and there's been some internal conversations that say, hey, we need to kind of put our foot on the gas here because we can't continue relying on our defense to bail us out. So I think there's a little bit more of an added focus to the Green Bay Packers offense this week. It looks like he's found his guy, Romeo Doubs. I know there was a big drop in the end zone.
That was a hell of a throw, by the way. I mean, Aaron Rodgers basically dropped that into a bucket. I think you and I might have caught that.
Couldn't have handed it to him any better. But I think you're starting to see some of the young weapons emerge, right? Christian Watson looks like he's got some burst. Big Bob Tonyan is kind of regaining his form post-ACL injury. So the weapons in the offense starting to get a little bit healthier, starting to gain a little bit of an identity. And I just don't like this Giants defense based upon the quarterbacks that they've faced. I think you're going to see this unit drop precipitously. And when we, you know, again, zoom out and have this conversation about the Giants defense in, you know, week 14, 15, 16, we're going to be like, ooh, this might be one of the worst defenses in the league.
I mean, that's what you have to do. I mean, we talk about how schedules aren't created equally all the time when you only have four data points. And to the Giants, Brian Daboll and company deserve a ton of credit. You're 3-1, but unfortunately in this business, it doesn't adhere to the quote that Bill Parcells has made so famous. You are what your record says you are. If you ascribe to that as a sports bettor, you and your bankroll will be soon separated from one another. So proceed with caution, but an interesting game to watch. Green Bay make their debut in London, and the first time actually in this London series where two NFL teams will travel overseas when both have a winning record. So finally the Brits get something to be excited about and see one of the iconic players at a marquee position in Aaron Rodgers. When you look at the games on Sunday afternoon, one stands out, and I think it's in Cleveland, where the Los Angeles Chargers will go on the road as short road favorites, a number that's been bet down a touch from a field goal. They're 2.5-point chalk pretty much across the board, and we'll call the total on this game 47.5. The top passing offense in the league in the form of the Chargers meets the league's second-best rushing offense in the Cleveland Browns. And if you're looking for zig and zag-type trends and scenarios here, these two teams have been the poster child for such. Cleveland 12-3 following a loss under head coach Kevin Stefanski, the best in the NFL spanning at least 15 games. Meanwhile, the Chargers have been the model of inconsistency, just 3-1 following a win under Brandon Staley, the worst in the league over a 10-game span. Injury-wise for Cleveland, it appears Myles Garrett will be a full go as he was back at practice, a situation you're going to want to monitor. Jadeveon Clowney remains the biggest name to keep tabs on for that Browns injury report. Offensively, they look to be a lot healthier there. Meanwhile, for the Chargers, Keenan Allen, a DNP on Wednesday, but we've seen the Chargers make up for his absence with the collection of their parts, Mike Williams being the breakout star of sorts. Last year, these two teams treated us to one of the more exciting games of the season. A 47-42 thriller in week 5 was actually the most total points scored in any game last year, a number that was surpassed this year, last weekend, by the Lions and Seahawks. Justin Herbert in that game, 398 passing yards, 5 touchdowns, no picks. And when you look at the Browns, they were able to run the ball when they wanted, where they wanted, how they wanted. Payne, passing offense versus a rushing offense, which defense may have the anecdote for the opposition on Sunday?
So, you know, just looking at the matchup on paper, the Browns haven't been able to stop the run. It's something we thought, if you go back to our season previews, could be a problem, especially on the interior, because we didn't think there was much proven depth along the defensive line. And, you know, when you miss both Myles Garrett and Jadeveon Clowney, who's one of the best run-setting edges for a decent sample of your season so far, you can see how the Browns are 30th in schedule-adjusted defensive rush efficiency, right? Myles Garrett, as you mentioned, returned to practice. Clowney did not. So that's the one that you really want to monitor. I think Garrett goes, maybe doesn't have a full complement of snaps, but I think he's out there. The Browns are also light on defense just based upon scheme and personnel, and that's why they've graded out the worst tackling team in the league. And it's not just tackling, right? But it's getting to ball carriers. Browns defense is bottom 5 in opponent yards per rush attempt before first contact. Now, the positive here is the Chargers haven't crushed anyone with their ground attack. Only 28% of rush attempts have gained 5 or more yards. That's dead last in the league in terms of schedule-adjusted rush efficiency. The Chargers are 30th. I think the Chargers will try to run it some. They had some level of relative success compared to what they've had in previous weeks, last week against Houston, although it wasn't great. But this part of the matchup is certainly bad on bad, and when you have that, there's always some variance that you have to factor for. The Chargers obviously are very much a pass first offense. They're third in early down pass rate over expectation. I think Justin Herbert performed better and, you know, looked healthier last week. It was a game that I watched pretty closely, but it was the Houston Texans defense. So you have to take it with a grain of salt. I know they're playing hard. I know they're a little bit better than they were last season, but it's not some great defense by any stretch. We know Keenan Allen re-aggravated the hamstring. That's not a good look for him playing this week. But going back to this side of the ball and the variance that it has, you look at the quarterbacks the Browns have faced. Again, you hate to bash on the guy, but it's Baker in game one of a brand new system. Baker right now, QB 32 out of 32 in QBR, and he's 11 points behind the second worst quarterback. Flacco week two, Maserati Mitch week three, who's been benched, and Marcus Mariota. So even
I feel like we should eulogize Maserati Mitch. He may have started his last game as a team's true number one starter, not out of emergency need.
Boy, I felt bad watching that
post-game
presser. He was upset. And you could tell Tomlin knew, because Tomlin's presser this week was very much about what he's not doing, very much about what the guys around the quarterback are not doing. Tough situation, especially being in that town, right? I mean, he had to come out and just be elite, because everyone saw Kenny Pickett in college and everyone remembers what Kenny Pickett's final season was. And so I do think long term he's probably the better option, and it'll be interesting to see. Obviously, George Pickens is quite happy. So getting back to the point here is, like, this is certainly a step up in class for the Browns defense, going from those four quarterbacks to Justin Herbert, even if he isn't 100%. We also have to, again, monitor the defensive situation for the Browns, because that has a massive impact, right? Knowing the Chargers right tackle had some issues coming into the season. That was a spot that we thought was a little bit down. Rashawn Slater, obviously down at left tackle. Corey Linsley, questionable for this one. So if you get that Garrett Clowney return, that'd be huge. But what's interesting about, you know, this matchup a little bit more in terms of the variance, why I see, or at least think about why some Browns money has come in this week, right? That was a game that was, you know, plus three just yesterday. We're now down to 2.5. That was a real position on the Browns. But right now, Justin Herbert's throwing with play action on 33% of dropbacks. The Browns' defense is number two in success rate defending play action passes. So when you think about this element of maybe the Browns' defense will show a little bit better against the run here based upon the Chargers not having a great rushing offense, and then when Justin Herbert does drop back to pass, he's throwing with such a high rate of play action, that's something the Browns defense has been fantastic defending. So there's just so much back and forth with positive things for both sides. It leads to some variance here, but you can ultimately start to tie these pieces together and understand why maybe the Browns defense could show a little bit better here than maybe the perception when you think Justin Herbert Chargers offense versus the Cleveland Browns defense. Especially, you know, think about the Browns defense here for a minute, Todd. First three quarters, ninth in EPA per play allowed. All of the hatred forward facing publicly, all of the calling for Joe Woods' head because of what's transpiring in the fourth quarter, right? It's just such a variance quarter, right? We've only played four of them. And then you have, like, you know, how the Jets game ended. That's where the drop off has really happened for the Browns defense. But there might be a little bit of an edge there if you say to yourself, hey, there's some fluky shit that went on in that Jets game. And you just look at the first three quarters, this has been a top 10 defense.
I mean, you mentioned variance, and the Chargers on the other side have been a poster child for something very similar. The Chargers have outscored their opponents 61-33 in the first half of games. I'm not sure what's going on at halftime, Payne. And of course, Kansas City had a big say in some of these numbers, but even the Texans were able to battle back when it looked like the Chargers were in firm control, up 27-7. The Bolts have been outscored 75-31 through the first four games in the second half. So Brandon Staley has to make some adjustments. You obviously have concerns about Cleveland's ability to run the football and wear them down, and I guess that's the question that I want to ask of you for the Chargers. We look at their yard per carry numbers outside the top 30. From a counting stat standpoint, the rush defense doesn't look bad, but from an overall defensive efficiency, is this Chargers defense against the run better than the unit we saw last year that was absolutely gashed and one of the major focal points they had to address in free agency?
Yeah, it's a great question, because the Browns are 29th in early down pass rate over expectation. So this is very much a run first offense, and that's where the handicap needs to start on this side of the ball. Efficiency wise, to your point, Chargers are 18th against the run and schedule adjusted defensive numbers there. That looks like a massive improvement year over year, going from dead last to roughly average. But if you look at some of the more predictive run numbers, the Chargers are still bottom five in rush yards per attempt before first contact. And now with all the fancy data we have, and it's something we've mentioned a few times in breakdowns over the years, directional running is important to monitor. And the Browns run game, if you've ever watched it, and I know sometimes run first offenses are a little bit boring, but if you like running football, their run game is just so exotic. They're pulling linemen and tight ends simultaneously. They're doing a ton of misdirection stuff. It's really a fun ground game to watch, along with some of those blocking concepts. But long story short here, so the Browns are very effective running on the edges. Doesn't matter if it's right end or left end, the Browns are top five in rush efficiency to the outside. The Chargers have been beaten up on the edge. That's been their weakness. Joey Bosa is not there to set the edge on one side. And while Asante Samuel Jr. has been a revelation and a fantastic cover corner, more than you could have ever expected, he avoids tackling at all costs. It's tough to watch on film, but he wants nothing to do.
That's what you learned down there at Florida State. One of the best defensive backs of all time avoided tackling at all costs.
So you look at the Chargers' directional run defense. They're 32nd, dead last, defending rushes to the right end. They're below average to the left. And that's important because the ground game has to go for Cleveland. Jacoby Brissett has looked good relative to our expectation of him. But the Browns have faced the easiest schedule of teams the first 4 weeks and the 28th toughest schedule of defenses. So you have to have that complimentary ground game for him. Brissett's also been substantially better throwing with the lead, throwing with play action. The latter isn't something the Chargers defense is sensitive to based on defensive scheme. The Chargers are top five in success rate defending play action. So you have to get this ground game going. And if you do, then Jacoby Brissett is a little bit better equipped to move the ball around. Obviously, last week it was a disaster. Amari Cooper somehow was not involved in that game. That's supposed to be the horse here. So when you look at this, again, it's kind of this threading the needle type of offense. The Browns have to be able to run. They have to hit some gashers on the edges, make Asante Samuel Jr. a willing tackler. They have to keep this game neutral because that's the game state Brissett is much better operating from.
I'm so curious to see David Njoku in this particular spot. He appears to be the number one receiver for Jacoby Brissett. Yeah. At least that's emerged over the last couple of weeks. And it's a matchup you highlighted going all the way back to the Chargers game against the Chiefs. How difficult it can be to get the tight end involved in plus situations, knowing you have a healthy Derwin James patrolling center field. So I think that's the game within the game. And if the Browns have to pass, what directions they can go to. Njoku is absolutely massive with 149 receiving yards last year against the Chargers, but James wasn't out there, and you saw Donovan Peoples-Jones add another 70 on five catches. The last thing I want to ask you on this campaign is about the total. Given some of the matchup concerns that you highlighted for both defenses and strengths that the offenses can have, are you surprised that the first move on this total has been to the under, keeping in mind that weather is always a very real concern at Cleveland this time of year?
Boy, this is a total that has my head a little bit in a pretzel. Our core number was a little bit more in line with where this opened. But as I broke this game down, and you can kind of gather the things that I have said, why this total's dipped a little bit, because you have a Browns offense that's going to need to be able to run the ball. So, clock ticking. You have a Jacoby Brissett who is coming off probably his worst throwing game of the season against a defense that defends the pass pretty well, especially against play action, which is where Jacoby Brissett's his best. You have a situation where, to your point, Brissett's favorite weapon is likely going to be negated just a little bit by Derwin James. And then on the other side of the ball, where the Browns have been most susceptible is on the ground. So what happens if the Chargers feel like they're having great success running the ball because they're doing it for 3 and 4 yards a pop, something they haven't really been able to do this season? Maybe they continue to run a little bit more. Keenan Allen still out. You have Ward, who was only targeted 3 times last week, gave up 0 receptions. That can maybe handle Mike Williams. Now, I know that matchup stature-wise feels like a little bit of a mismatch, and maybe it will ultimately become that. But Denzel Ward's becoming one of the premier cover corners in this league. And then when you think about JOK, what he did to Kyle Pitts, Gerald Everett's been a little bit of a matchup nightmare for some defenses, and Justin Herbert's focused on getting him the ball, but JOK probably removes him. So when you think about some of the matchups, when you think about how these teams need to attack, when you think about how the offense have been really utilizing play action, but that might not go so swimmingly here, suddenly you can see why the under 49 was hit a little bit.
Yeah, I can't give JOK that much credit. I blame Arthur Smith for the removal of
part of it's Arthur Smith, but JOK is like the best, one of the best cover linebackers in the league. It's not close.
No, he's been outstanding, and I think it's a great point on Denzel Ward. A lot of people go, well, look, the Falcons only threw it 19 times. There's a reason that their game plan was only to throw it 19 times. They knew they weren't going to have much success testing some of those athletic corners, specifically in Denzel Ward, who is one of the more underappreciated guys, given the fact that there's other members of that secondary alongside him that haven't exactly lived up to lofty expectations coming into their NFL careers. Into Sunday afternoon, Payne, and you mentioned at the top of the show that we would be getting back to the Rams, and here we are as the Rams will welcome in the Dallas Cowboys. This game, 5, 5.5, kind of that dead zone between two secondary key numbers of 4 and 6. Total down a shade from where it opened at 45.5, now down to 43. There are some 43.5s out there in the market. And for those folks who are trying to figure out exactly what home field advantage will look like in this matchup, let me save you the trouble. It will feel like a Cowboys home game. The Cowboys fan base significantly stronger in Southern California than the Rams or Chargers. We know that their practice facility is in Oxnard, so you will see plenty of Cowboys colors in there. Let's see if the Rams have to go to a silent count early in this football game. Obviously, the players to watch, at least through the early going of the season, are both on the defensive side. Micah Parsons is the defensive player of the year favorite for a reason. Created 89 pressures since coming into the league. It's tied for 7th in the league. Meanwhile, the defensive counterpart on the other side does business in a very different manner. Aaron Donald supplying a rush up the middle. 102 pressure since 2021, 3rd in the NFL. The Cowboys, well, they've been road warriors and ATS juggernauts. 1 and covered 5 straight on the road. And like I said, I'm not sure this counts as a road game. At least they'll be in the visitors' locker room. The Cowboys, meanwhile, though, they've been great overall in terms of exceeding odds makers' expectations. Now on a 16-5 ATS run, their last 21. The Rams, they find themselves trying to avoid dubious distinctions here. 2 defending champions since 2000 have had a losing record through the first 5 games of the season. The 2006 Steelers and the 2018 Eagles both started 2-3. Payne, this is a Rams team that has a short week turnaround and has a myriad of injuries that they may have to address in the secondary. But I ask, even with a healthy Michael Gallup, can the Cowboys take advantage of where the Rams may have a deficiency in that back seven?
I'm going to derail this conversation because as you were leading us to the promised land of Cowboys-Rams football, the Washington Commanders taking big bets,
you know what,
again this week. The boys just can't get enough.
That may be the best thing to happen to my bankroll because I told you early in the week if that game sat at 3, my hand was going to be forced as a small value bet. I was going to watch a quarter and absolutely hate my life. Now it may take it off the table completely at 1.5. That's no man's land.
I sent the warning shot against the Eagles a couple weeks ago, and I was like, I'm hearing some things. I would stay away. Game day, just a six-figure pummeling into the market. They just didn't listen. And then last week, we were very close again, and fortunately, they took the hook ahead of us and saved us some money. And then this week, not just the 3, came in and took 2.5. So
I can't wait for Washington to close a favorite and the opportunity to tease the Titans up through the 7 the way this number is trending right now.
I get it. I'm not huge on the Tennessee Titans. These have been 2-sell teams all along. But boy, you need to see some fight and some effort before you start taking Washington in these just wins type situations.
I told you. That's just me. Okay. Sam Howell out there already. I've seen enough Carson Wentz. Let's go. Get the kid out there.
Oh, that experiment is done and over with. I just don't know if you want to get the kid buried with that behind that offensive line. Okay. Cowboys Rams. On paper, you know, these aren't the best games this week. We had a tough time coming up with 5. Fortunately, there was a London game, so we had air quotes, three primetime games. So I think we'd be a little more concise here, especially when we, you know, just broke the Rams down ad nauseum last week and then again on Monday. But this is one of those 4 o'clock games that's, I think, probably the most interesting 4 o'clock game. So here we are. The Rams offense and offensive line has some issues. Now, maybe there's a glimmer of hope. Brian Allen had his knee procedure. They thought it would be a 2 to 4 week injury. This is roughly week four. McVay has insinuated he has some hope there. Maybe they press him to go in a big swing game like this, knowing your backup center, Colton Shelton, left with a high ankle sprain against the 49ers and is now on IR. You don't want to go to your third string center in a game like this against the Dallas defense that's number one in pressure rate. You would think left guard David Edwards would be up after missing last week with the concussion. I understand the protocol is a little bit different and dicey right now with the Tua situation. And then on Saturday, when they thought he might get cleared, he had an illness. So we just have to monitor the offensive line here. But across the board, you're looking at a Rams offense that we've mentioned just is struggling, right? They're 26th in schedule adjusted efficiency. And some of their success has been predicated on who they play. You look at weeks 2 and 3 against the Falcons and Cardinals. Rams were 9th in EPA per play those 2 weeks. Weeks 1 and 4 against the top two defenses in the league and the Bills and 49ers, Rams could not get anything going offensively. I reference that because Dallas right now, top 5 defense and schedule adjusted efficiency. It's in that class. Probably not as good, probably a couple more holes, but it's a different class, okay? And we've seen the Rams struggle there. And the other thing here is Dallas has shown an ability this season to be able to get some pressure without blitzing, which is nice compared to what they were doing last season. And then we go back to our discussion Monday night. Aside from Cooper Kupp, who else is keeping defensive coordinators up at night right now?
Ben Skowronek.
You know, I mean, and he's helping as kind of like an inline blocker, almost like a second tight end. Stafford's intended air yards are now the 4th lowest in the league, so there hasn't been much pop downfield. The rushing game is below average in schedule adjusted efficiency. Maybe that's an area where you find success against Dallas, because that's the area we pinpointed where we didn't necessarily love the interior of their defensive line. They cheaped out there. They were hoping for some young guys to step up. Really hasn't been the case. Dallas is 25th against the run this season. So maybe you have some success just handing the ball off there a little bit more than usual, and you alleviate some pressure from Stafford. Make the Cowboys, you know, have to worry about both the run and pass, so they can't just pin their ears back and pummel Stafford, who's been sacked on nearly 10% of dropbacks this season. Quickly on the other side of the ball, the Rams defense has been solid stopping the run. 3rd in schedule adjusted rush efficiency. The Rams secondary hasn't been great. Jalen Ramsey not playing to his normal level. Troy Hill on IR. Jordan Fuller dinged up for this game, won't be out there. And you think about the Cowboys receiver group, it's getting healthier with Gallup and Schultz back, and you have Noah Brown emerging as a complement to CeeDee Lamb. And sure, Cooper Rush looks competent. He's 4-0 in his starts. It's all you can hope for as a Cowboys fan. He's won some important games as you're, you know, buying time for Dak's return. But look who Cooper Rush has played. The Giants and Washington are not good defensively at all. And once the Bengals made some adjustments, Dallas scored 6 points the final 45 minutes of that game. Dallas won, but finished 21st in success rate on offense week 2 against Cincinnati. You put those two things together, and you can see why this total has gone from 45.5 on the reopen to as low as 43 this morning, blowing through far and away the largest key number in totals of 44 here.
What do you make of the side kind of being placed in no man's land? We talked about the look-ahead number being as high as 7. It did get as low as 4 before it looks like there was a little bit of an appetite for the favorite here as we sit stagnant in that 5, 5.5 range.
That's always the debate you're going to have as a handicapper, because you go back just to that week 2 game I referenced against Cincinnati and you're a 7.5-point home dog. Now all of a sudden you go out on the road against a desperate Rams team and you are a 4.5-point dog. So the market is really doing one of two things, probably overvaluing or probably both, right? Overvaluing Cooper Rush and the Dallas Cowboys based upon who they've played and beaten, and you're downgrading the Rams off a public humiliation on Monday night against the 49ers, and then obviously didn't look good in prime time against the Bills to open the season either. So I think that's probably where some of the value was realized by professional bettors who got out and laid the Rams at some cheaper prices this week. Ultimately, I don't know where the next move goes. It feels like this might be the right number pending some injuries, right? Do you get the two linemen back for the Rams? And if you do, suddenly you might have a chance to be able to pass protect against the Cowboys. Jordan Lewis for the Cowboys in the secondary is also a little bit dinged up. You'll have to monitor that. So I think the next move will be based upon the injury report as we sit here in no man's land, to your point, at 5.5. But some sharp money on the Rams earlier this week, certainly, kind of buying low.
Hat tip to the Cowboys' overall body of work, not necessarily offensively, but Dan Quinn, a coach that we took plenty of shots at over the years when he was in charge in Atlanta, definitely paying dividends for everything they've done defensively. Micah Parsons this week basically scaring every Cowboys fan, saying he would go to the ends of the earth for Dan Quinn. We'll see what that actually means if Quinn gets another head coaching job when Parsons hits the open market, theoretically. I will give McCarthy credit as well, Payne. He was a little bit of a poet, channeling his inner Walt Whitman this week. He called the defense the thermostat of this Cowboys team, all about regulating performance. So Lord only knows what that means as they make the trip out west. Should be a great game to figure out if the Rams can get themselves back on track and if the Cowboys can get their signature win on a young season, knowing Dak Prescott's waiting in the wings, most likely to return as starter in week 6. You can follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there as well. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And I should have reminded you guys earlier at the top of the show, but I'll take the opportunity here to sign up and subscribe to the Bet the Board newsletter. It's the single best piece of information in case you miss a podcast during the week, you happen to miss an article, some additional prop bets, great analysis in there. It's absolutely free, delivered directly to you every single Friday during the football season. Take the 2 minutes, sign up, subscribe, and reap the benefits where it matters most at the betting window. All right, Payne, from games that lacked a little bit of intrigue that were worth discussing to, I think, what could be defined as one of the marquee matchups of the entire weekend, Sunday Night Football between the Baltimore Ravens and the Cincinnati Bengals. The Baltimore Ravens, a field goal favorite, a number trending towards 3.5. We haven't gotten there yet other than a rogue 3.5 or 2. Total on the game, 48.5. And the Baltimore Ravens now have lost 5 straight games at home. I know Lamar Jackson hasn't been the starting quarterback in all of those matchups, but more importantly, they've blown back-to-back 17-point leads in home games. The first team to blow 17-point leads in back-to-back home games since the 2011 Minnesota Vikings. Ironically enough, the Ravens had been absolute nails in those spots before. They'd won 75 straight when they were previously in that position. They've now lost 7 straight games decided by one score. It's the longest active streak in the National Football League since Buffalo beat them last weekend, ending their longer streak. And when you look at the way this series went last year, the Bengals absolutely dismantled the Ravens. And Joe Burrow came out and said, we'd had a good season up to that point, but winning at Baltimore the way we did kind of proved to ourselves that we were who we thought we were. Joe Burrow, 941 yards passing versus the Ravens, most by any quarterback versus any team in a season in NFL history, became the first player with 400-yard passing games versus a single team in a season all time. It is worth noting that Marcus Peters was out all season. Marlon Humphrey also missed the second meeting. But they were the first team with 2 20-point wins versus the Ravens in a season, a plus 44 score differential, and Ja'Marr Chase and T. Higgins absolutely feasted in those matchups. What can Baltimore do differently here to force Cincinnati to be more methodical, eliminate the chunk plays that have really plagued the Ravens' defense, not just against the Bengals, but against most elite passing attacks they've faced so far this season and even a good portion of last?
You know, talent matters. Players matter. But of all the games on the board, and I understand it's Sunday Night Football, this is very much about X's and O's. Cincinnati knew coming into the season they would see more two high shell looks. Joe Burrow and the Bengals offense still haven't figured out how to play that style of defense yet. They said they spent the entire offseason trying to figure out how to combat that because they expected it to come. But right now, Burrow has massive splits against two high shell compared to non-two high shell looks. If you look at his numbers, Burrow is ninth best in EPA per dropback against non-too high looks. He's the seventh worst against too high shell looks. And if you kind of think about this Ravens defense, they made some changes this offseason to be more multiple in scheme and not just this downhill aggressive blitz unit. So through 4 weeks, the Ravens have used too high shell at the 18th highest rate. They've been the ninth best in terms of EPA per pass allowed when they use that coverage the first three quarters. And I think what you're going to see ultimately is that coverage is going to be employed far more this game. They should actually want to live in it. And if you go back to some of the priors this season, both the Steelers and Cowboys really jacked up their usage of this too high shell, right? This is the defense that teams started implementing last season to combat the Kansas City Chiefs offense. And now they're doing it to really hinder the Cincinnati Bengals. So you're looking at both the Steelers and Cowboys who jacked up their usage. They beat the Bengals. Miami didn't use it often enough and got beat. And I understand that's not how their defensive scheme or style is based. And traditionally, they hadn't been good using it. But if you looked at those splits, when the Dolphins did use it, the Bengals did virtually nothing. The Jets used it more than Miami did. It's just not a good defense. And when you go back to last season, you referenced this a little bit, but that Week 16 matchup was really interesting because the Ravens jacked up their usage. So the first time these teams played last year, the Ravens used the too high shell look 16% of the time. Got absolutely torched. I believe Marlon Humphrey was absolutely crushed in that game. You go to the second matchup, though, the Ravens upped their usage of too high shell 44% of the time. So they knew what they had to run defensively. But you think about the injuries that we've talked about in that secondary during our previews. The Ravens just didn't have the horses to execute it because they were decimated with those injuries in the secondary. So I truly believe, right, we can talk about how good Jamar Chase is and all the yards per route run, and we can talk about, you know, the offensive line and Joe Burrow struggling a little bit. This, to me, is all about how the Ravens elect to come out defensively. And you have to come out in too high shell and force the Bengals to prove to you that they can beat it. And I understand the Bengals have a little bit more of, you know, some extended rest and prep. This is probably something they focused on, but it's something they focused on all offseason because they knew it was coming as well and still haven't been able to figure out how to execute against it. So to me, that's what this is about. If the Ravens come out in the right scheme, I think they're going to have some success here defensively.
Well, you mentioned the Bengals knowing they were going to be faced with this and the Ravens having to adjust for what was perceived to be their biggest division rival on paper. Meanwhile, on the other side, you read some of the comments coming out of Cincinnati. They said that they dedicated certain days throughout the course of the offseason to game plan for the Ravens, knowing how unique a challenge it is when you face Lamar Jackson. So far this week, rookie Cam Taylor-Britt, who's still returning from injury, has played Lamar Jackson, a former high school quarterback who had modest numbers at that point. And Lou Anarumo had some strong things to say about it. But when you look at the Bengals and their game plan, at least from the first meeting against Lamar, because Tyler Huntley was out there in the second meeting, they got after him. They kept him in the pocket, 7 pressures, 5 sacks, and they realized that if they were going to lose to the Ravens, Lamar was going to have to do it as a pocket passer. Given what we've seen through the first 4 weeks, it's all about Lamar Jackson's running ability to keep this Ravens offense going as J.K. Dobbins returns to health. Can Cincinnati have some success doing the exact same things that they were able to deploy last year in keeping Lamar contained?
I don't see why not, right? And I think here's the other interesting element here is something we'll monitor. Rashad Bateman has a midfoot injury. Kept him out the entire fourth quarter last week against Buffalo. They went out and signed Andy Isabella hours after he was released by Arizona.
Pride of UMass.
That's going to be something to monitor here, because if Bateman's out, who is your outside receiver? I understand Devin Duvernay looks pretty good and you still have Mark Andrews. Who's the guy outside? And the one thing that we've noticed, as well as Lamar Jackson's played, he's been carrying this offense with a lot of explosives. He's been pushing the ball downfield specifically to Rashad Bateman, and that's why Lamar has the fifth highest intended air yards. This offense has been very explosive. It's been very spurty, but extremely average down to down when you look at some efficiency numbers, when you look at some success rate numbers. And it also feels like you're putting so much on Lamar Jackson's plate that he's starting to wear down some late in these games. And if you look at some of his numbers in the second half, it's really indicating a guy that's just becoming, I don't want to say fatigued, I don't want to say tired. Certainly some adjustments are being made by opposing defenses, but the numbers in the third and fourth quarter aren't remotely close to what they are early on in this game. Now, maybe he gets some help. Ronnie Stanley is trending towards playing. Getting your left tackle back would be huge in a game like this, especially knowing that your backup left tackle is already out. So you're playing with your third string left tackle. So that would be a massive boost. To your point, though, about what we might see from Lou Anarumo's defense, I think you're going to see some rush three, drop eight. And if you look at Lamar Jackson, he's number one in EPA against four-man rushes this season. But against this rush three, drop eight, he's 23rd out of 29 qualifying quarterbacks in EPA versus this rush three, drop eight. The Bengals use this well above league average, especially on third downs. They use it at the third highest rate on third downs. The other interesting thing here is just in totality, the Bengals defense has been fantastic with in-game adjustments. If you look at some of the scoring that they've allowed in the second half, Lou Anarumo is really, I never saw it in Miami. You never really saw any signs of it ever. But he has single-handedly really helped this team probably more than its head coach in terms of what he's done defensively, what he's done at halftime making some of these adjustments. I mean, the Bengals right now, 1.3 points allowed per possession. That's second best in the NFL. So again, like, there's some matchups here that are interesting, but I do believe it comes down to the style and the scheme defensively. This is just one of those weird games. When I saw it, you're thinking, Cincinnati Bengals, boy. A lot of weapons offensively, improved the O-line. There's just a lot of dudes here. Baltimore, you're like, wow, like, great tight end, great quarterback. To me, this is the most X's and O's game that we have on the entire board, and quite possibly for an entire game that we've seen or covered or broken down this season to this point. It's wild because it's going to come down exactly to what these defenses throw out there. And it wouldn't completely shock me to see this game get hit under.
It's so interesting for all the points that you outlined there and what Lou Anarumo has done. I mean, people that watch Bengals games casually saw that on full display in terms of what they were able to accomplish in the postseason and that improbable run that came up just short against the Rams in Los Angeles fighting for the Super Bowl. And you look at this Bengals defensive configuration, a little bit different with no DJ Reader in the middle of the defensive line. Larry Ogunjobi was extremely integral in the success they had in containing Lamar Jackson. But Buffalo did a great job last week neutralizing Mark Andrews. And to your point, given the weather and everything else that was there, Baltimore struggled to find some of those chunk plays. You look at what Von Bell and Logan Wilson can do. Those guys a little bit underrated in coverage. So such a fascinating chess match, given the level of familiarity, given the importance in the division, especially as the Browns and Steelers try and figure their way out. This will go a long way, in my opinion, in terms of catapulting one of these teams into the catbird seat. When you look at the odds to win the division, Baltimore right now around even money, the Bengals in that plus 180 range. So a fascinating matchup for a variety of reasons, and one that every football fan who likes to watch the game within the game should be looking forward to on Sunday night.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. And I don't know why, but it's just the vibe you get that this feels more important for the Baltimore Ravens.
I think it has to be, given the way that they haven't been able to hold serve at home, given all that they've heard about blowing 17-point leads. And Payne, blowing those leads, you know, if you lose those games the way they did to teams that we think are going to make the postseason, and the Miami Dolphins and the Bills, you can live with losses. But knowing that you're sitting at 2-2 right now, and you very realistically could be 4-0 in an extremely difficult conference, that can't sit well in the locker room. And I think that's part of the reason we saw that frustration bubble over in the waning moments of that game between Marcus Peters and John Harbaugh. Harbaugh said he's going to let bygones be bygones, essentially. But Marcus Peters, when asked by a reporter yesterday at practice, didn't want to talk about it. So you can tell there's a little bit of pressure and a little bit of fire, knowing that this defense was absolutely embarrassed by the Bengals in the two meetings last year.
The Ravens this season have trailed for just 8% of their offensive snaps. It's the lowest rate in the league by a long mile. And yet you sit here at 2-2. So there is some pressure. I think this game does mean a little bit more to the Baltimore Ravens. It's interesting as we kind of creep out here closer to 3.5 on, you just have to monitor the Rashad Bateman situation. I think that for a team that's depleted at receiver, potentially not having him out there, that would be a big blow. I think ultimately he is the driving force to whether we get to 3.5 or we settle back in it at 3 or maybe even go to soft 3. That's kind of been the synopsis of the guys that I've spoken to, in that if Baltimore was laying 2.5, it's a buy. If Cincinnati got to 3.5, maybe it's a buy there. 3 kind of felt like the right number. And I think ultimately we'll head where Rashad Bateman ultimately becomes like the deciding factor here. It just wasn't a good sign last week from him not playing a critical game like that in the fourth quarter.
It almost feels like this rivalry within the division right now, not as defensive minded as what we grew accustomed to when the Steelers and Ravens had their annual battles, but odds makers are going to be in the spot where, you know what, we're going to hang a 3 when Baltimore plays at home. We're going to hang a 3 when Cincinnati plays at home, and we're going to let the market take it one way or another based on some of the players and availability that are there. So no doubt an interesting side in total to keep tabs on throughout the course of the week. Again, want to remind all of you loyal listeners out there to follow Payne on Twitter at Payne Insider. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast at Bet the Board Pod. And if you're more than a National Football League fan, we have plenty of great listening opportunities in the Bet the Board Arsenal, the college football podcast with all of the marquee games for the upcoming weekend. The NASCAR podcast Stay Green goes live on Friday. And we also debuted a brand new non-sports betting podcast all about the investment opportunities in the sports memorabilia space called, what is it, Cardboard Chat, I think is what we went with there.
Cardboard Chat.
And so Payne gets to play host, which in and of itself is worth a listen. And he does that podcast with PWCC Marketplace minority owner Jesse Craig. So for all of you guys that find yourselves in that sports memorabilia and sports card space, I think you'll truly enjoy the listen as something unique that we've added to our arsenal. But the other thing we want to add to our arsenal, Payne, we've been on a nice little streak around these parts, and it's all about stacking winners on top of one another. As far as investment opportunities for NFL Week 5 are concerned, take us to the promised land.
So we've hinted at this a little bit, and I don't like it as much as Monday night because there are some... The Rams secondary certainly isn't at full strength by any stretch. Let's go back to the well. Cowboys Rams first half under, there's 21.5 at some of the larger shops there that are taking the largest limits, right? Pinnacle is there right now minus $1.13. I think that's the way we want to go. I would say, you know, 21 is certainly fine, but 21.5 out there is widely available. The other thing here, Todd, is I really think there's one of the better opportunities for a teaser out there this week. It's one that I've played myself. And I think you probably get the Sunday started with using a 6-point teaser here. So a second best bet, Packers to Jaguars. And we broke down the Packers-Giants game already. It's timestamped to top, but I just think you have a Packers team that is itching to get out. This is a good spot for them where we've kind of been looking to fade the Giants. 3-1, it's a great start. I get it. They just haven't really played anybody yet. And so this is going to be a little bit of a shock to their system. And I think that's a very good teaser leg. You can get you can use a 6-pointer, get the Packers down to minus 1.5 there. And I'd like to pair it actually with the Jacksonville Jaguars. So getting the Jaguars down to 1. I really like what I've seen from Jacksonville. And I understand last week they fell a little bit short, didn't exceed expectations. It was a monsoon out there. It was freezing cold. When the weather was at least better early on in that game, they built a 14-0 lead over a team that we thought was very good. You went out on the road, beat the Chargers. You stifled the Colts. Now, I understand that it's not the best team in the league, but you beat them 24-0. At 2-2, this feels like a massive game for Jacksonville. Are you for real? Or are you going to go back to being the previous version of the Jacksonville Jaguars? I like Doug Peterson. It feels like his team is fully bought in here. This is a massive game for Jacksonville. And so I think those are two great teaser legs. So let's make that a second best bet, Todd. Packers to Jaguars.
Huge opportunity for the Jags. If you can get to 3-2 on the season, you get a little bit of help from the Denver Broncos tonight on Thursday Night Football. Suddenly, you go from being an afterthought in the division to maybe being the team to beat with all of the offseason acquisitions. So fascinating storylines, to say the least. And as we always encourage you guys, our loyal listeners out there, please, please, please shop around for the best teaser prices. I know out here in the desert, there are some shops charging charging upwards of $1.50 for a six-pointer. Do not, under any circumstance, bet into that particular market. There's no sense paying a premium for a bet that's widely available. So we know that some of the most prominent shops out there will give you a six-pointer at minus $1.20. Take advantage of that. There's no reason to lower the win expectancy by getting your hand forced at some of these shops looking to take advantage of players that don't know any better. Anything else?
It's all a numbers game. You know?
Oh, there's no doubt about it.
In your front, right. And in offshore, there's just like a bevy of places that offer minus 10. And then also knowing what the value of these teasers are. So, you know, sometimes you think in your head, adding more teams negates the edge. But in reality, right, if you can get a three-team teaser, six-pointer at plus 180, and there's a couple offshores that offer that as well, that would be the equivalent of a two-teamer at even money. So if you are in Vegas and you're like, ooh, minus 150 steep, right? Like, shop around a little bit, because sometimes you can navigate that market a little bit better to where, you know, offshore, if you're getting a plus 180 on a three-teamer, again, that's the equivalent of a two-teamer at even money. So just kind of knowing some of the pricing situations around these teasers makes a world of difference.
Exactly.
As well.
And look, we know that some of you guys are out there. This is a recreational pursuit as much as anything else. It's not hard to put a little extra money into a couple of books. We're not saying you need 15 to 20 outs like a true professional, but there's no excuse in this day and age not to have at least 2 to 3 books. Take advantage of the best numbers that are there. It's the little things that you can do to keep your money in play longer. Enjoy this recreational pursuit. And for the most part, you know, letting us try and guide you to the promised land, taking advantage and hopefully keeping you in the black all season long to turn a profit when they hand out the Lombardi Trophy.
You're going to take us down into like other parts of sports betting here, but I think the other thing that you need to be cognizant of is when you're going to search out these accounts and you're going to have multiple of them, make sure they're different, right? Like the idea of like, hey, I'm going to go get a Will Hill account, and maybe if I double down and get a Caesars account, like it's the same, right? It's the same place, right? You want to have varying types of accounts. And I think that's the biggest thing. If you're only going to have 2 or 3, you know, get an offshore, have a local out, right? You know, use what you're using in Vegas, right? Have the accounts have different personalities, I think is the way to put that.
Exactly. You need a diversity of shops, the same way that if you're working on any home improvements, you don't go in there with 3 screwdrivers when you need a hammer, you need a wrench, and you need a screwdriver to try and get it done. It's the best analogy I could come up with. My answer and solution to that is call a guy that can fix things, because I'm only going to screw it up further. Anything else you'd like to add before we get out of Dodge and put a bow on what has been a tremendous week of content, as always, around the Bet the Board home offices?
That's everything. I was a little foggy and groggy today, operating about 3.5 hours of sleep. I'm going to try to get 6 tonight.
Well, it's a good thing that you're going to have hopefully a chance to rest and recover in the coming days. We need you at full speed, Payne. Can't have you going on IL. You're not allowed to miss any time with a midfoot sprain or anything along those lines. We leave that for the players out on the field. You're going to have to play hurt.
There we go.
All right.
There we go.
Best of luck.
Good pep talk, coach.
Best of luck to all of you, our loyal listeners out there. Good luck with all of your investments, both pro, college, and anywhere else they may take you this weekend. And hopefully, with a first half under ticket on the Rams and Cowboys come Sunday afternoon, we'll see you at the window.
Thanks for listening to Bet the Board. You can catch Todd and Payne every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday during football season, breaking down the biggest NFL and college football games. And to make sure you don't miss any free best bets, subscribe to Bet the Board on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.